Good morning. We are back, Bostopia News with Evan George, to do the part two of why Boston has to beg on its knees to the State House for things so small as a liquor license. Now, if you have not yet, pause this episode, go back and listen to the most recent one. I think it's called Brahmins and Booze or Booze and Brahmins, something like that, because you're going to need a lot of that background. Because as I explained in that episode, if you really want to understand the history of Boston's liquor licenses, you can't just go back to 2014 when we expanded it a little. Can't just go back to 2006 when we expanded it a little. You can't just go back to 1933 and 1906, two very important dates that we're going to bring up in this episode. But you really did need to go back to about the mid-19th century where Boston began to experience a wave of Irish immigrants who were too poor to really keep going west. And where I believe we left off on that episode is 1906. And that date is very important for two different reasons. One, it was the election of John F. Fitzgerald, the, I believe, maternal grandfather of John F. Kennedy. Now, I think the election itself took place December 2005. Back then, the mayor of Boston was elected every year, which is insane. But I think he was sworn in. We're just going to call it 1906. He will also be known as Honey Fitz throughout this podcast. And that is the first reason why that date is very significant. And the second is that that is the date where a lot of municipal powers began to be stripped away from Boston into the state legislature. And much to my chagrin, I really can't find good books and articles about that specific process. A lot of it just seems to be referenced and alluded to, but I looked for a few hours and I really couldn't find. I read quite a few articles, quickly flew through quite a few books, and really couldn't find some great writing about that 1906 process of the how and the why and all the specifics, the nitty-gritty details that I like to read into of when they actually stripped the power away from Boston. However, as I outlined in that first episode, it's really not hard to get a sense of the social, political, and economic climate that was around in that time period and how it matches what was happening, mostly around the power of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, the Brahmins, the wealthy elites, wanting to take powers away from now the Irish-infested municipal takeover of Boston, as, again, I outlined in that previous episode. And for this episode, we are going to pick right back up in 1906 with Honey Fitz. And we will probably end just around the end of Prohibition, 1933, when Boston's current liquor laws were established. So here we go. John Francis Honey Fitz Fitzgerald, born February 11th, 1863. Now, not too much of a shock, and I'm going to be reading from a Boston.com article, Meet Honey Fitz, the Pixie-like Mayor of Boston, written by Nick DaCosta Kepler, May 17th, 2017. The son of poor Irish immigrants in the North End and the fourth of 12 children, three of whom died in infancy, his early friends knew him as Johnny Fitz or Fitzy. Historian Robert Dalek recalled in the Kennedy biography, An Unfinished Life. He graduated Boston Latin School, attended Harvard Medical School for a year until his father died in 1885, where he then returned home to support his family and began entering the world of politics. And I am also drawing from a National Park Service article called The Johnny Fitzgerald, Mayor of a Bigger, Better, and Busier Boston. No author listed. After his father's death, Fitzgerald went to his ward boss, Matthew Keeney, for help. Keeney hired him as a personal assistant. Driven and hardworking, Fitzgerald advanced in the ward ranks. This is back when political wards were the political machines. Think of Tammany Hall, and we're going to get to that dynamic in a little bit. And Johnny Fitz was able to win a seat on the Boston Common Council in 1861. They had a vastly different city council, and we're going to talk loosely about the charter reform of 1909, which kind of like broke apart and stripped Boston's current government. Basically, we used to have a massive legislature. It was something like 80 seats just for Boston. And then it was a bicameral chamber, meaning like there was two different chambers, like kind of like a Congress and a Senate. And then that second chamber is really what we now see as the Boston City Council. It was all at large, which was another move. We're going to get to all this, but just think of previous to 1909, Boston's local municipal government used to be much bigger. And in my mind, that is a much better process. Do you need a bicameral chamber? Do you need two chambers? No. But one big one, I really like that. Anyway, he's elected onto that in 1891. He then won the state Senate in 1892. And then at just the age of 31, he won a seat on the U.S. House of Representatives at 1894. Still reading from that Boston.com article. As a congressman, Fitzgerald authored legislation to fund construction of Boston's subway system and the Cape Cod Canal and battled anti-immigrant sentiment, even from within his own delegation. Now, this is very important. He famously convinced President Grover Cleveland to veto a House-approved anti-immigration bill by his fellow Bay Stater, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Fitzgerald later claimed the two political adversaries had the following exchange after he gave a speech rebuking the Republican senator. So this is Honey Fitz as like a young congressman going against Massachusetts senators that are filing all of these anti-immigration bills, really to try to make it harder to become a citizen. It had to do with like a literacy test. And here's a reported exchange between Honey Fitz and this senator, Henry Cabot Lodge. And if you remember from the last episode, the Cabots, part of the Brahmin aristocracy. "You are an impugnant young man," Lodge reportedly said after running into Fitzgerald in the halls of the Capitol. "Do you think the Jews and the Italians have any right in this country?" To which Fitzgerald replied, "As much as your father or mine. It was only a difference of a few ships." And doesn't that just perfectly mirror what we are currently seeing in the debate around immigration, particularly here in Massachusetts, where you have some people who, after immigrating here and their families, now want to wall it up, say no more, and then you have other people saying they have just as much a right to this country as your father did or mine. It's just a difference of who got on what ship. Love it. He served three terms in Congress and then, in 1905, decided to run for mayor of Boston. And when, like, we sometimes look at it like, all right, you want to run for municipal government, then you want to run for state positions, then you want to run for federal positions. There is also, and I forget who said this, like, there are only three jobs worth having: mayor, governor, and president, essentially saying that an executive position is so much better than if you're just, like, you know, one of a few hundred congressmen, like, you have no power, you have nothing, you just have a fancy title, you get to go into fancy buildings, but it's the executive where you are the ruler of whatever room you walk into. And so he decides in 1905 to run for mayor of Boston with the slogans, "Bigger, better, busier Boston." I would love for someone to run on the slogan of a busier Boston. Right? That would get voted down immediately. He also denounced the ward boss system, proclaiming, and I'm reading back to that National Park article, proclaiming, "The people, not the bosses, must rule," ignoring his own rise to the political machine. And just a little bit about his time as mayor, Fitzgerald became popular through his efforts to expand the city. By the end of his second term, he had established Fenway Park, the Franklin Park Zoo, numerous public playgrounds and parks. He was beloved for opening public spaces to people that had traditionally been excluded from them. And then just to tell you a little bit about his end, but we are going to return to his administration because it's very important to the topic at hand. Fitzgerald briefly stood for election again in 1913, only to be rocked by scandal. Rumors of an affair with a cigarette girl, Elizabeth Toodles Ryan, emerged. Fitzgerald withdrew from the race just 3 weeks after he had entered it. His political career never recovered. Despite the disastrous Toodles affair, Fitzgerald remained a popular figure in Boston for his personality as well as his politics. And for a little flavor of what he was like, back to that Boston.com article, a pixie-like character. By all accounts, Fitzgerald had an outgoing, colorful personality. A pixie-like character with florid face, bright eyes, and sandy hair, he was a showman who could have had a career in vaudeville, Delic wrote in his book. His demeanor eventually earned him the nickname Honey Fitz, as did his penchant for breaking into song at social events. Someone else is quoted saying his name was Honey Fitz because he was a smooth talker and loved to sing. Another person describing as, Fitzgerald was a charming, impish, affable lover of people who perfected the Irish switch, chatting amiably with one person while pumping another's hand and gazing fondly at a third, he wrote. More simply, Robert said of the turn-of-the-century politician, he was a BS artist. So that is the man that, upon his election, the Brahmins, our state overlords, decided to rip power away. And it's not just because he was this charismatic figure and he ran on populist messaging, though I'm sure that didn't help, but essentially it had to do with a much larger national movement that we describe as the progressive movement. And one of the big things that the progressive movement rallied against is what we refer to as the spoils system. And I'm going to describe for you what that is through the lens of Fitz's administration, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. And I'm going to read from you from a book, Rogues and Redeemers, When Politics Was King in Irish Boston, by Gerard O'Neill. But his first term was an unfocused flea market, with the City Hall turnstile whirling and no one quite in charge. This is a very negative view, by the way, of the spoil system and his first term. With a budget of $33 million, the city outspent the state by 4-1, with a seat-of-the-pants mayor running 44 departments, employing 12,000 people to serve a city of nearly 600,000. His fevered pace precluded a more thoughtful approach to the spoil system that had become second nature to him. Fitzgerald kicked open the vault door and, making no bones about it, went on a spending spree to reward supporters with jobs and city services. He framed the political dynamic for a generation, City Hall as a spillover cornucopia for constituents funded by real estate taxes on commercial property. It turned the old Yankee equation on its head. By the end, one of every 42 residents in Boston held a city job that kept them inside when it rained and finally out of the construction trench. Bartenders and construction foremen were suddenly running the show. The provisional appointment to get around civil service became an art. There were ludicrous new jobs for tea warmers and tree climbers, and a new tier of watchmen to better watch those warming tea or climbing trees. And what this book is describing, I'm going to read you a couple other articles that just get into more of the numbers about what was happening, is again the spoils system, where essentially you vote for us and we will give you jobs. We will reward you with city employment. And this was attacked by, again, the progressive movement. I keep alluding to it. I'm going to talk more about the progressive movement in a second. But essentially, they had the fundamental belief, and I think a lot of people listening to this will at first start nodding their head, that we need to have competent people in charge. You cannot just reward your friends and your buddies and your brother and your nephews, because, again, this is mostly still male employment, with jobs and positions simply because you know them or simply because they were able to organize votes for you. That's wrong. It needs to go to the professionals. We need to have the right people in charge, and you are all not picking the right people. And this is when it gets into a little bit of the anti-democratic nature of the progressive movement. And before we explore that, I can kind of hold both ideas in my head simultaneously, where one, yes, there are certainly some positions that you need to have qualified people in charge of. However, the concept that if I vote for you, you will now give me a job that improves my livelihood and that of my family, that is a good thing. Like, you know, when that book was very, like, which clearly the author hated the system, was describing like tea warmers and tree climbers, like he's almost describing universal employment. And it's just like, oh, hey, like, we're just going to kind of give you money to do nothing. So then, you know, you can survive. Like, wouldn't that be nice if our government just provided people with the resources to survive? Now, clearly it's tough to do on a municipal level. Like, we're not going to get into all that. But try to, like, weigh both things in your head, where, yes, we do need to have experts in technical positions, but simultaneously, concepts like universal employment or voting for your own material benefit and that of your family, those are good things. And going back to how Fitzgerald did this, now reading from an article, Beyond the Ballot Box, A Social History of the Boston Irish, 1845 to 1917, by Dennis P. Ryan, University of Massachusetts Amherst, doctoral dissertation from 2014. Thank you very much, sir. Fitzgerald's election as mayor in 1906 ushered in what was literally a golden age for Irish contractors. Because of existing statutes governing the granting of contracts, the mayor was in an ideal position to reward builders who had contributed money to his campaign. According to the law, any contract under $2,000 could be awarded without a public bid, meaning you don't need to say, hey, we have this job open, you take a bunch of bids on that job, you normally have to pick like the lowest one. If it's under $2,000, again, back then in 1906 dollars, you can wave away all that and you can just award it to whoever you want. Furthermore, those contracts exceeded $2,000 could be dispensed without advertisement as long as the mayor approved them in writing. A consummate opportunist, Honey Fitz found these regulations perfectly suited to his mode of government. He had an especially keen memory when it came to Irish contractors. During his first term, the list of contractors awarded projects by city departments, such as Sewer Division, read like a membership roll of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, which I'm assuming is some Irish Catholic thing. Of some 162 contracts awarded by the Sewer Department in 1906, nearly 61% went to individuals with last names like Rooney, O'Brien, and Shaughnessy. So this is the, you know, the Irish payoffs, essentially. Rewarding your own constituents, this rising, this massive group of Irish immigrants who will then continue to vote for you to stay in office so then they can continue to get these jobs. And just to further hit this home, another Ward Bosses and Reformers, an analysis of Boston's Irish political machine, 1884 to 1914 by Andrew Martin, written in 2017, another UMass Amherst. This is an undergraduate paper, which kind of makes sense because, to be honest, I found some errors in his sourcing. Anyway, this element looks to be good. This power was built on patronage. Granting the Irish money, food, and jobs allowed them to rise out of poverty into the middle class. By the early 20th century, Irish families were able to move out of the slums and become teachers, nurses, and employees for the gas company. The city government also began to reflect the city's increasingly Irish demographics. The relative number of Irish municipal employees in Boston rose from 5% in 1870 to 32% in 1900. As a result, the Irish came to comprise a respectable block of the city. Reading a little bit ahead, the Irish were numerous, needy, and registered to vote at a much higher rate than the non-Irish, 60% to 37% respectively. For that reason, the bosses, meaning like the ward bosses, the political machine bosses, tampered with the system to benefit the Irish at the expense of the non-Irish. They used their influence as a way to punish and weaken rivals. Since many judges and city hall employees were a machine appointed, they denied permits and business licenses to labor organizations, socialists, and insurgent ethnic groups, especially Jews and Italian. Now, do we think that the Brahmins wanted to take this power over awarding licenses away from the municipal government because they wanted to protect labor unions, socialists, and rising ethnic groups like Jews, Italians, and Germans? No. They just wanted control over it to be able to reward their buddies. I'm almost positive they had no greater love for the Italian Catholics than they did the Irish ones. However, now we finally get to it. This era referred to as the Progressive Era, which is somewhere between 1896 and 1917, or maybe 1896 and 1919. Depends on when you would have put the dates. Doesn't really matter around that. And they are essentially trying to solve the problem that we discussed in the first episode, that with the rising immigrant class coming into America, relatively poor, the reconstitution of cities as industrial workplaces and, you know, the rise of the Industrial Revolution as we generally see it in our minds. Again, like the first Industrial Revolution was not about factories. It was a lot more about technological advancements and like systems of production, but not really factories as we see them. But that second Industrial Revolution, that later part of the 19th century, coincided with this massive immigrant population, with land being controlled by fewer and fewer people, people then needing to sell their labor, not able to have self-sufficient yeoman farmers like Jefferson thought, because again, all these people were writing before the Industrial Revolution. They couldn't imagine what was about to happen. And cities becoming dirty. We didn't have modern plumbing. We didn't really get how diseases functioned. And so the Progressive Era was trying to right a lot of these problems. And also simultaneously, there was some stuff going on at the federal level. We're not going to talk about it, but basically, they finally started to take things out of the democratic process. Like back then, one of the biggest things you would vote on is, should we add silver as part of our like reverse, our reserve currency? Should we have tariffs? And these are things that we don't get to talk about today, that in our democratic input, you and I are not establishing tariff policy. And I would argue for worse, that all of that is taken out of the democratic realm and being run by what we're told are the experts. That when we're discussing finances and our economy, we don't really get to vote on that stuff. But back then, you got to. And in this progressive era, they start to really have this anti-immigrant element of saying, you know what, democracy isn't really working. We don't want these rubes, these dirty immigrants, voting on these matters. We need the professionals to do it. And as I said before, we can have two different thoughts in our head simultaneously, that there are problems with the spoils system, with the patronage networks as described in municipal governments. However, that type of universal employment, voting for your own material self-interest and letting democratic input over what are some of the larger decisions that, again, today we don't really get to have a say on, is, I would argue, for the better. And what the progressive movement wanted to do and did successfully do here in Boston was really take down these ward political bosses and really remove the power away from democratic input and towards more formal institutions that can protect against the wills of the mob. And to do that, you had to attack democracy. So this is a piece, Why Progressives Wanted Less Democracy and Lower Voter Turnout, written in 2019. I think it's Mrs. Wire, a Mize Wire. In fact, there were new political, quote-unquote, reforms beginning in the 1890s that had ostensible democratic motivations, but were really designed to reduce voter choice, especially among poor liturgical voters, which I think has dual meanings, but is, I think, can be viewed as both religious voters and voters that vote collectively in a public way, almost religiously. All right, but either way, you know, it works for the topic at hand. They include changes to voter registration, the Australian secret ballot, the short ballot, he adds in woman suffrage, which is a little bit odd in this, whatever, political primaries and referendums, and direct election of senators. Voter registration requirements and other restrictions became prominent during the progressive era. These included poll taxes, literacy requirements. And remember, one of the things that Johnny Fitz, when he was a congressman, convinced Calvin Coolidge about was about these types of literacy requirements. Again, all this anti-immigrant legislation that was happening, that was all simultaneously part of the progressive era. They placed additional regulations on voting, such as to disallow alien voting, increase the time it took to become a citizen, and made it more difficult to become one. The ostensible reason was to reduce election fraud and increase transparency, but the real intended effect was to reduce participation of certain minorities, such as ethnic urban immigrants. And then he continues a little bit later down, nowhere was this restrictionist trend clearer than in the case of the South, with restrictive Jim Crow legislation and racial hostility towards blacks caused voter turnout to plummet. And so when I think all of us like have an understanding of the Jim Crow South, the black codes, if you ever like want to look at crazy statistics, look at like voting participation in like Alabama and how much black voting, black turnout went from like 95% and like 1890 to like 1% in like 1905. Like it's some crazy amount of the drop off. Like if you look at the amount of black electeds in the South, like they were dominant for like a good like 10 to 20 year period post the Civil War. And then all of it gets ripped away. So simultaneously, while that's happening in the South, we have a version of that up here in the North, but it is just a lot more tailored towards immigrants and stopping these immigrants from having as much democratic input. And just to read a little bit specifically about Massachusetts, this is from James J. Connolly, Reconstituting Ethnic Politics, Boston, 1909 to 1925. Henry Adams once described 19th century Massachusetts party politics as the systematic organization of hatreds. At first glance, his observation appears to be true for the early 20th century as well, especially for Boston, where Brahmin reformers battled Irish bosses in an apparent reprise of a half-century-old conflict. But a closer examination reveals that while ethnic hatreds grew stronger in the city's 20th century public life, progressive reform weakened partisan organization. Reading a little bit further down, progressive municipal reform destroyed the ward-based party organizations that were the linchpin of this political culture and engendered new forms of local political action. A series of reform measures beginning in the late 19th century increased the number of civil service-protected experts in local government, ended partisan control of nominations for political officials, and finally rewrote the city charter to eliminate formal partisanship in ward-based elections in city politics. And again, all this is happening around that big 1906 date when Boston lost control of its own liquor licenses. So all of this is to try to break down the control of these party bosses, which again is completely mirrored and interlined with Irish Catholics. And this is where we see that merger of anti-immigrant hatred with like municipal civil reforms and how they coalesce together during this time. And here in Boston, they had their own organization around this. Reading back to Martin's piece. In the wake of this disunity, he's talking about kind of like rival political bosses fighting each other, a new enemy determined to clean up the graft and corruption formed in 1903. The Good Government Association, an organization of businessmen, vowed to find appropriate men to fill city posts rather than the many already there who the GGA, Good Government Association, claimed were incompetent and unscrupulous. Which, while sounds admirable, almost always when people are talking about cleaning up corruption, they have their own motives. Just continuing to read. Despite the purity of the GGA's declared motivations, O'Connor argued that they had a sinister, aggressive desire to play ethnic politics against the Irish population, that they were determined to, quote, to support candidates for public office who possessed breeding, education, experience, and integrity. Again, that breeding element. Don't have too much time to go back into the eugenics movement. Probably be a whole different topic. I'll do it another time. They believed in their duty to oppose the type of Irish politician who was more interested in jobs, contracts, and personal favors than in good, honest government. The GGA were a formidable enemy of the ward boss system, a well-funded organization that can mold the anti-ward boss and anti-Irish sentiments of the city. And this is when we have the big charter reforms that completely changed Boston's local government in 1909. And I know I'm like kind of going around and not even talking about Boston liquor licenses anymore, but it's just so important to understand what is happening to the city of Boston, to the state, these larger political forces, to just get that why we still have these things on the books, that like this is what is going on in the climate, in the ether, while all these things are happening. And so while the Boston liquor license is being taken away is like, you know, the focus ideally of what I'm trying to get across in these two episodes. And like, why do we have to go beg to the state house? This is all what's happening in the background. All of these forces and like our loss of control over liquor licenses is really just one small element of that. And as I mentioned before, we used to have a much bigger city government. And because it was a much larger legislative chamber, it was something like 70 or 80 seats. Each one was their own ward. And that's kind of like how the ward bosses controlled what was happening. However, as part of this GGA, this charter reform, they wanted to get rid of all of that, to simplify it and to spread it out so that while we still had a lot of Irish immigrants, we had a lot of other immigrants. And if you reduced things from a district level, just to use the language of today, to at large, you can dilute all those strong population concentrated areas. And that is ostensibly what they managed to do. Again, all of this under the guise of good government, which really there are the business interests behind it because they want control of the licenses. And they put forward two different plans. One would maintain, at some point in the early 20th century, they went from the one mayoral term, you have to run every year, to 2 year. So their first plan would be to keep the 2 year mayoral term and then get rid of the two different legislative chambers and create a single one with 27 different districts and 9 at large. Again, we're getting close to what we have today. Or a plan 2, which would have the mayor seat go from 2 years to 4 years and then create a single body of 9 at large members. So both of this would get rid of the Board of Aldermen, which we now call like the City Council and the Common Council. Which, as I said before, I want us to have a much larger Boston City Council district level. I don't want two chambers, though, because one of them is always going to be at some level, like all at large. I think of it how like the Senate kind of operates. So no, one chamber. It should be much more proportional than it is, rather than having one city councilor for, what is it, like 50,000 people? More than that. And what ended up happening with the vote was the ward bosses couldn't really all get along and figure out what should they all vote for in their collective interests. So some were telling their people to vote for Plan 1, others kept with Plan 2. But under the guise of, hey, all of those other ethnic groups, those social formations, the non-Irish, you're getting screwed in the current system. So we need to break apart these ward bosses. We need to take this out of their hand. Lo and behold, we end up with that Plan 2, switching it to the 9 all at large. But enough of all that. Again, a little bit of a tangent. I think it's important. Let's get back to everyone's favorite topic, drinking. And from 1906 to about 1919/1920, nothing really changed. We had the state controlling our liquor licenses. We still had a really Irish-dominated political force, even though, as we just discussed, the ward bosses, that machine started to break down in terms of the larger progressive movement. They still had power. They still had the numbers. They still had the social ties to really have Boston still be an Irish city. However, a little thing called the 18th Amendment, and I can't talk too much about the Prohibition movement here in Boston or the Temperance movement. Massachusetts, I think from like somewhere around the 1830s, was one of the first states to put limitations on alcohol. So, I mean, you know, we get the Puritans here. We can go back to the early to mid 17th century. You want to look at the whole history of that. Let's just skip it. And then we had the Prohibition era, which we can just mark as 1920 to 1933. And I found a fun article to just kind of go through Boston this time period by Emily Sweeney. This was written in 2016, titled 5 Things What You Don't Know About Prohibition in Massachusetts. Number 1, the first dry day. On January 17, 1920, Prohibition went into effect, and the 27-year-old storekeeper in Dorchester was among the first to be arrested for violating the new dry law. Police claimed that he sold high-proof Jamaican ginger extract, known as, I'm going to go with Jakey, to an undercover officer. Police raided his store at 107 Park Street in Dorchester and seized several bottles of the stuff. Number 2, lady bootleggers. In April 1922, the Boston Globe reported on the sudden rise of baby carriage bootleggers and described women as champion booze hiders. The article revealed the strategies that women used at the time, tucking bottles under blankets, under mattresses, and even hiding hooch on their young children. See, number 3 is busted about a police raid in 1921. Number 4, titled Hide and Seek, May 1930. 1930 is an important date. I'll explain why in a second. Police uncovered a new way of dispensing liquor at a drugstore at 2662 Washington Street in Roxbury. They discovered a phone booth at the place containing a sliding back door that led to a secret room where a clerk delivered the customer's orders. And number 5 is just about another club raid. Whatever, just to get a little taste of what's going on. But as I mentioned, 1930 was an important year because in Massachusetts, there was a ballot initiative, question 2, 1930, called the Massachusetts Repeal of Alcohol Prohibition Act. Now, how I think this law would have went into effect in practice, because it got voted yes for a very large margin. The yes vote was almost 64%, so it was 2-1 vote. Was basically they would stop all enforcement of prohibition. And obviously you can't control what federal like officials like FBI or, you know, the ATF do. But basically here in Massachusetts, no longer be enforcing it at the municipal or state level from our police forces. So again, that passed, but it wasn't really too soon after that in 1933 when we had the passage of repeal of prohibition, 21st Amendment, which was ratified December 5th, 1933. And now that is, again, that same year that we have the Massachusetts law, which governs liquor laws to this day, particularly around licensing. And why we chose the current thing that we do, again, recognizing all of the history that we just went into, was now states needed to try to figure out, now that prohibition's been repealed, alcohol's back, are we going to let municipal governments keep doing it? Who's going to do the state? As I outlined before, here in Massachusetts from 1906, it has been a state matter for reasons we've already discussed. And then we had to figure out, are we going to keep this and what is that going to look like? And here is where there was something called the Rockefeller Report. So in December of 1933, there was a report done by John D. Rockefeller Jr. Well, he at least paid for the study, which was then released in October of that same year, which was titled Toward Liquor Control. The author is Raymond Fosdick and Albert Scott, and I am currently reading from the law offices of John P. Connell, The History of Price Discrimination and Anti-Inducement Laws in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And this report, quote, became the Bible for state legislatures that were tasked with enacting state laws that would govern post-prohibition distribution of alcoholic beverages. And again, it's the Rockefellers, one of the wealthiest, well-connected families, not necessarily a Boston Brahmin, but again, you know the type, is commissioning a paper which then says that the laws that we should have, which, you know, still governed by temperance and public safety, should be around state control in a three-tier system, which is what Massachusetts adopted, which is why we have, like, different licensing, like one for beer and wine, the other for liquor, beer and wine, so on and so forth. All of it, again, came from this report, but as we outlined before, the history and the reasons why and the restrictions and the control, all of that really was that 1906. And that is why I wanted to spend almost an entire episode just around that area and what was going on in the psyche. And for our history, that's basically it. That, you know, I basically needed two episodes to really talk about that early 20th century period when all this was codified. And I think in like the 1930s, people were just so thrilled that you could have a legal drink again that no one was thinking about reversing that 1906 law to get it back into municipal control. Some people probably were. My guess is everyone was just ecstatic that we could drink again. Now, I did find one funny article that I just wanted to share with you. This was in the Boston Globe on December 3rd, 1947. So now alcohol has been allowed back here in Massachusetts for about 14 years. Here is the article in the Globe. Unattached females in drinking places target of Donlin Bill. Aimed at keeping unattached females out of drinking places for their own betterment and for the comfort of the men patrons, a bill was filed at the State House yesterday by Representative Edmund J. Donlin, Democrat of West Roxbury. That's right, West Roxbury, which would greatly reduce the number of restaurant licenses. Establishments which are unable to show that 50% of their gross receipts are for the sale of food would be denied restaurant liquor licenses, which carry with them permission to serve women and stay open until 1 a.m., all mornings but Sunday. In place of restaurant licenses, Donlin said the places would be given tavern licenses, which would restrict their clients to men and require them to close at 11. Oh, okay. Wait, last sentence. The barroom, which is just another name for a tavern, said Donlin, must be restored to its pre-prohibition status as a male institution where a man could take a drink and relax without being molested by a lot of unattached females. I'm not going to comment on it. Just wanted you all to know. State Rep from West Roxbury, 1947. And I realized that I never actually got to the combat zone, which I think what we're going to do, I just have one or two more things to share with you about this, about like Boston liquor licenses, because it really is its own standalone thing. I think I'm going to just record a separate episode about the combat zone for next week. And then following that, I have a great interview lined up about immigration, which I think kind of just naturally flows with what we've been talking about. But the two other things that you should, or really just one other a big thing that you should kind of keep in mind about like Boston liquor licenses, despite the massive history I gave you, is, and this is from a 2011 article titled The Scapegoats in Boston Magazine, two black politicians have already been convicted of taking bribes, but the real crime when it comes to awarding valuable liquor licenses in Boston is the abuse that remains perfectly legal. And so the two bribes, and I'm sure if you listen to this, you have some familiarity with these. They would both need to be two separate episodes, but one involving State Senator Diane Wilkerson when she was caught, you know, stuffing the money into a bra, which became, you know, a very iconic image. And then secondly, Chuck Turner, who was then sentenced for taking a $1,000 bribe. And I know that one has like even more very shady elements, not about Chuck Turner, but about like what was constituting a bribe and a lot of people saying him taking like that $1,000, which again, a pretty petty sum, like in comparison of things, was him just like giving it actually like back to the community in some way. Again, there's some levels of corruption I'm fine with, to be honest. But I know the Chuck Turner stuff is a lot more complicated than just like politician takes bribe. And a lot of people say he didn't really do it. But anyway, whole different topic. Well, both of those instances occurred really in between 2006 and 2014. And the reason those dates are significant is that is when Boston slowly got to get more liquor licenses. Nothing really changed from 1933 to 2006. And those two politicians, again, being charged with corruption and really just kind of like re-entering the zeitgeist of Boston is a place of corruption that at the municipal level still cannot be trusted. Now, fortunately, as I discussed in the first episode, a few years after this, Boston regained the right to just appoint our own people on our own liquor licenses, to the effect that these two criminal charges had is minimal. And honestly, this Boston Magazine piece kind of had a great sentence about it. Here it is. Last month, Diane Wilkerson was sentenced for accepting more than $23,000 in bribes. This month, Chuck Turner will be sentenced for taking a $1,000 bribe. And by next month, we'll likely forget about the whole thing. Yet the Turner and Wilkerson cases shined a light on a part of the city notable for its brutally political cover my ass first and screw you second trysts. But for all the questions those cases answered, there was so much that remained concealed. Convicting two politicians may provide a sense of civic satisfaction that bad deeds inevitably result in punishment. But as a review of court transcripts, case documents, and numerous interviews makes clear, it did nothing to address the larger issues Ron Wilburn first brought to the FBI. And what this entire piece is really about is the innate corrupt nature of Boston's liquor licenses. Like, beyond the history and beyond the economic forces and why, again, things I talked about in the first episode, like why this hasn't changed, like in well over a century, is because there are people that are benefiting from the status quo. And it's not just necessarily the people who hold liquor licenses, but the people who are in positions of power to grant the limited licenses that exist. I'm going to keep reading from this Boston Magazine piece. The limited supply creates a pent-up demand, which results in licenses selling for a great deal in some neighborhoods north of $350,000. Now, again, this is an old article from 2011. That number has now about doubled. To get one, a restaurateur needs not only money, but also connections. Businesses must be approved by local neighborhood associations, local elected officials. The role these officials play in granting a liquor license cannot be overstated. In most cases, it's a mere commercial transaction. But here, entire state committees and boards are given to the handling of liquor and its licenses, which practically invites corruption. After Wilburn approached Wilkerson, for instance, she ultimately helped draft a law granting more liquor licenses in the city of Boston. But there are also the subtler, more insidious conflicts. And maybe as a follow-up, it might be worth me spending more time on this element of the liquor licenses in terms of, again, why these things haven't changed, like despite the history, which I hope you learned something. And just to really kind of hit this point home and like this whole other element as to why our liquor licenses are the way they are, here's another Boston Magazine article. This is from 2009, titled "The Drinks Are on Them." In dominating the city's liquor license scene, the law firm of McDermott, Quilty and Miller has lots to celebrate. The rest of us, not so much. And what this gets at is, like, again, the behind-the-scenes processes of when we have this restriction of liquor licenses and all the backroom deals and the people you need to know to secure one of these licenses. It goes in. I'm going to just kind of read around a little bit. But the board's power, the board referring to the liquor license board, which, again, up to this point in 2009 is appointed by the governor, will a few years later be appointed by the mayor. But the board's power extends beyond determining who can serve booze, because so few restaurants can make a profit without alcohol sales. The three commissioners, it's a three-member body, effectively decide which establishments will be able to survive and which will not. The situation may be frustrating for would-be restaurateurs, but it's been a godsend by one small law firm. The same group that represented, and this alludes to an earlier story in this, but the law firm McDermott, Quilty, and Miller. Nobody, it turns out, is better at getting a desired outcome from the Boston Licensing Board. In 2006, for example, when the state took the rare step of allowing the city to dole out 20 new full liquor licenses, nearly two-thirds went to their clients. And what I want to leave you with is, like, thinking back on that good government association from the early 20th century, you know, we're going to clean up graft and corruption, this spoil system, which is being managed by one specific ethnic immigrant population for, like, their own people's benefit. Again, there are some good elements to that stuff that I like, some that I agree with are wrong, but it's under the guise of we're going to clean up this corruption. But instead, what you ended up having happened always, almost always, is simply that control over who gets to grant power and jobs and wealth and capital is just moving from one group to another. And in the case of Massachusetts and here in Boston, it went from a local immigrant population that seized power and then for the benefit of their own people to a much smaller group of elites that still to this day, again, from this article, of these law firms and these people who sit on these boards who have so much power and control, and it's all beyond the democratic scope. We don't vote on this stuff anymore. That all of it is just behind the scenes in this black box. And so you still have a group of people who are just rewarding their own friends, their own family members with these things. Just to read you again one other quote from that Boston Magazine article. The state's Byzantine laws mean McDermott, Quilty, and Miller also plays an outsized role in one of Boston's most high-profile industries. In a very real sense, these lawyers are the arbiters of where and how we eat in this town. It is this small group of elites that are making these major cities that are affecting the entire geography and population of Boston. But where previously, in the early 20th century, where it was just a lot more transparent and in the open, and dare I say democratic, about who is getting these rewards and privileges and licenses, it is now behind the scenes by a small group of wealthy people who, I'm sorry, are basically still the Brahmins. And with that, we'll close this episode. I hope you enjoyed the last two. I hope you learned something. If you did, great way of saying thank you is heading to patreon.com/bostopianews. You can send me a couple bucks. Keeps you up to date with all the little things I do. You know, you're not just supporting the weekly podcast. You're supporting all the TikTok videos I do. Election season's coming up. You want me to have a little influence over people before they vote. Got to keep making the TikToks. And your way of supporting that is by supporting me. Patreon.com/bostopianews. And if you can't financially contribute, I fully understand. I'm giving you all this for free. That is not a knock on creators who don't. I am in a position where I can. However, the more money behind this account, the more legitimacy it's granted in the eyes of others. And so, while again, I'm not going to like preach poverty and that I'm about to be kicked out of my apartment if you don't subscribe, the more money behind it, the more people will see that this outlet is one that has legitimacy and that independent news, that you can't have a source and you don't even need to use paywalls. Again, all this a little bit of an experimentation. But yes, thank you to everyone for supporting the show. I'm looking forward to doing, as I said, we're going to do the Combat Zone probably next, just like a little one-off episode. Great interview following that and many more to come. And so with that, take care. And as always, hope you have a great rest of your day.